It's been hailed as the one key biometric anyone can measure easily that gives the best all-round indicator of health and stress on the body. As more devices are able to collect high-quality heart rate variability, also known as HRV data, during the night, a few questions have come up. Questions such as, what data should we use as a HRV score? What is a good HRV? Why is my HRV plummeting after a glass of wine? And should I be using HRV to train? These questions have been flooding my inbox. I've been wanting to dive deep into the HRV literature for quite some time. My community is very big on wearables such as wearing the Whoop and or Oura Ring. So they know what HRV is, and they have, of course, been asking me for advice on understanding HRV. So I went out over months in search of the best person to talk to about this, and I came across a man, an applied sports scientist, researcher, and coach, and his name is Dan Plews. As a researcher, Dan completed his PhD in the area of applied heart rate variability. This work focused on implementing and validating methods regarding the application of HRV to track training adaptation in elite athletes. Since then, Dan has gone on to having more than 50 peer-reviewed publications in the area of applied sports science and exercise physiology. Dan now focuses on his company, Endure IQ, a company dedicated to coaching the world's best triathletes. As we move into the podcast, I would recommend that you grab a pen and paper as we'll be going deep into HRV and you don't want to miss anything. Also, as always, we're going to do some housekeeping. Here are some key points to take home about HRV before we even start the episode. Number one, heart rate variability measures the specific changes in time between successive heartbeats. The greater this variability is, the more ready your body is to execute at a high level. Secondly, when you have a high heart rate variability, it means that your body is responsive to both sets of inputs, that is the parasympathetic nervous system and the sympathetic nervous system. This is a sign that your nervous system is balanced and that your body is very capable of adapting to its environment and performing at its best. On the other hand, if you have a low heart rate variability, one branch is dominating and sending stronger signals to your heart than the other. There are times when it's a good thing, like if you're running a race, you want your body to focus on allocating resources to your legs as opposed to digesting food. However, if you're not doing something active, low HRV indicates your body is working hard for some other reason. Maybe you're sick, maybe you're stressed. And this leaves fewer resources available to dedicate towards exercising, competing, and giving a presentation at work, for example. So I'm very excited to get into the above points and more. So here we go. Let's get into the episode with Dan Plews. Neuroscience, neurology, longevity, and beyond. Learn everything you need to know from the best physicians and experts in the world. The Neuro Experience Podcast is a platform to help you understand what the brain is and how it shapes every part of our lives. Every episode comes to you from highly credible sources. I'm Louisa Nicola, medical neuroscientist from Australia living in New York City. Come and take a neuro experience with me. Before we move forward, in keeping with the theme of today's episode, which is all based on performance, I'd like to make note of our wonderful sponsors. The first one is 8Sleep. Now, here's my secret. I sleep on a performance mattress. 8Sleep's Pod Pro cover is the easiest and fastest way to sleep at the perfect temperature. It pairs dynamic cooling and heating with biometric tracking to offer the most advanced solution on the market. Here's how it works. You can add the Pod Pro cover to your current mattress and set the temperature using your phone. It comes with an app. Then you start sleeping at a temperature as cool as 55 degrees Fahrenheit or as hot as 110 degrees Fahrenheit. It also splits your bed in half, so your partner can choose a totally different temperature, which will definitely be a game changer for many of you. And now, my dear listeners, that's you. You can get $150 off the Pod Pro cover. Simply go to 8sleep.com/Louisa to claim this offer. So if you want to be sleeping better and you want to start maximizing on temperature control, you want to get yourself a high-performing mattress. And that is what I sleep on. I currently sleep on the Pod Pro cover. I didn't want to change up my mattress, so I just simply got the cover and I covered my current mattress with it. And you can do the same too. It's an absolute game changer to your HRV and your overall daily performance. So if you want to get this, you can get $150 off by going to 8sleep. That is eighsleep.com/Louisa. Also, this episode is brought to us by my favorite greens, Athletic Greens, your all-in-one nutritional and gut health formula. I use this each morning after the gym. I mix one scoop in cold water and chug it down before I start my day. It gives me certainty that I'm able to get all those 72 vitamins and minerals that we all need in just one hit. If you want to try this, be sure to head over to athleticgreens.com/neuro, where you will get a free travel pack and a 1-year supply of vitamin D in liquid form. Also, as a personal note, I track my glucose avidly by using a CGM, which is a continuous glucose monitor. And for some reason, when I have Athletic Greens, I don't see my glucose spiking as much during the day. It's as if I'm more stable and coherent when I take the greens. It pretty much stabilizes me. So this is something personal that I found extremely useful and another added benefit to taking the greens formula. So once again, if you aren't having any form of greens, or if you simply want to maximize your efficiency when it comes to the gut microbiome, if you really want to stabilize the gut bacteria, you can take advantage of my exclusive member discount. Just go to athleticgreens.com/neuro and you can claim this offer. You'll also get a travel pack and a 1-year supply of vitamin D3. Dan, welcome to the Neuro Experience Podcast. I'm very excited to have you here for several reasons. One being, I've read a lot of your research and I've actually heard a lot of your podcasts. And I think that it's been long overdue here on the Neuro Experience Podcast. We get a lot of questions regarding HRV, heart rate variability. And I'm sure you know this all too well over the last 2 to 5 years with wearables such as Whoop and the Oura Ring coming to the forefront of social media. A lot of people are learning about this quote unquote HRV. And I think I speak for everyone when I say that we'd love just a quick background or a HRV 101. But before we get into it, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about how you got into HRV training and what you currently do now?
Yeah, well, thanks for the introduction, Louisa. My background is in exercise physiology. So I studied sports science at Loughborough University. For those who might know a bit of the sports science scene, Loughborough is probably one of the most prestigious sports science universities in the world, based in the UK. But primarily, I was actually there under a scholarship. So I had a scholarship working with triathlon. I was a pretty good junior and youth triathlete. So my background was always, I guess I was always more passionate as an athlete than I was as an academic, certainly in my younger years. I can't say I was the best student when I was at Loughborough University, that's for sure. But then I got into coaching and I went and did my master's degree also in exercise physiology. Did some coaching in triathlon for a while before I kind of decided that sports science was more of my thing and got really into the sports science side of things. And I moved over to Singapore. Actually, when I moved to Singapore, originally I was with, I was working in triathlon coaching, but quickly moved over to the Singapore Institute of Sport, where I was doing primarily exercise physiology. And that's where my interest in HRV began, because I met who was my PhD supervisor, who became my PhD supervisor, was Professor Paul Lawson. I met him over there. He got a job working for the New Zealand Academy of Sport, which is now High Performance Sport New Zealand, as a head of physiology. He pulled me over to do a scholarship, doing a PhD that was in heart rate variability. And that's how the whole journey began in terms of heart variability and my interest in it, because he was working with Dr. Martin Bouchette, who's done a lot of work in the area of heart variability. He was formerly with Paris Saint-Germain football team. And together as three, we kind of pioneered, pulled together a PhD, pulled together some lots of unanswered questions. As you rightly said in the intro, back then, you know, this was in 2010, 2009. It wasn't really a big thing, HRV. But, you know, what we really wanted to understand, there was some studies that had come out looking at HRV guided training, and we felt that, you know, more understanding was needed. And that's where the whole journey began. And I think it's, you know, in terms of PhD topics, it was now such a, I'm so thankful for it because it really has rocketed into orbit since the whole area of HRV since I've taken on that, since I completed and took on that PhD.
Yeah, you were definitely in front of the market with that one. I can't imagine what it would have been like back then, really studying it and getting into it. I don't know if you're aware of the research of Inigo San Milan. Have you read some of his research?
Yes, I know Inigo San Milan. Yeah, I know him. Well, I don't know him personally, but I've read a lot of his work, specifically around diabetes and the mitochondrial function stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, he's incredible, and we can probably get into his research later on. But what I really love is the fact that you were a triathlete, and that's, you know, I was a triathlete for Australia as well. Went to Worlds, did Beijing, London, and then Auckland. Then I called it quits in 2012. It was Auckland 2012 Worlds. Yeah, so I obviously didn't compete at a level that you did. I just made it to Olympic distance, and that was it for me. But that's where I really honed in on my sports science as well. I found my love for understanding my heart rate. I remember back in when I first started, and this was back when I was 17, I bought my first Polar watch, and it was just incredible to really track my heart rate back then. Just to having a watch that was able to track my heart rate, to now being able to track HRV, so on and so forth. So why don't we start there? Why don't we go into what exactly is heart rate variability? Let's start off at a really 101 introductory level.
HRV, so what is HRV? And I guess HRV is links back to the autonomic nervous system. So the autonomic nervous system is something that we're completely, it's something that we have no regulation over. So things like when we walk into a room, our pupils dilate, we can, you know, we feel hot, we feel cold, we have all the things that happen automatically without our conscious control in the human physiology, which is governed, which is basically what the autonomic nervous system is governing. But the autonomic nervous system is made up of two branches. Well, it's made up of the two branches that we talk about mostly, which are the parasympathetic branch and the sympathetic branch. So the parasympathetic branch is mostly known as kind of the rest and digest, so relaxation. As you know, we're sat here quite now, we're hopefully a little bit relaxed, but predominantly in this parasympathetic state. But when we get into more of a fight or flight, or we get stressed, or we get nervous, we then shift more into what's known as a sympathetic state, which is like, why is it known as fight or flight? Because you kind of, you get quite alerted, and you will either fight or flight. And the idea is that these two things are generally related to changes in heart rate as well. So the parasympathetic activity is related to reductions and slowing in heart rate, whereas sympathetic activity is associated with increases in heart rate, which of course makes perfect sense. If we think about fight or flight, we have an increase in heart rate. And we all know that if we get a fright, you know, you can often feel your heart beating in your chest, and you can actually feel that increase in heart rate. When you can't quite relax, you have a much lower resting heart rate. And of course, this is really interesting for people generally, because then from an athlete perspective, we can start to understand when we're more recovered, and also when we're less recovered and more stressed. Where this comes back to heart rate variability is that what HRV is doing is it's looking at the gap between each heartbeat, and it's looking at how much that gap is varying. So even if you, as you and me sit here right now and say our heart rate is 60, it doesn't necessarily mean that the gap between each heartbeat is just 1 second. In fact, it's varying all the time. Every single gap is different. So it might be 800 milliseconds, 1,000 milliseconds, 1,300 milliseconds. And that's actually what you want. And if the more variation you have, the more parasympathetic activity you have. And the lower variation you have, the more sympathetic activity you have. So when you're exercising, there's very, very little variation between heartbeats, because you're getting into more of a stressed and sympathetic state.
So what, okay, so just, you know, just to break that down a bit more, would you say it would be the average across a 24-hour period of sympathetic versus parasympathetic?
Well, there's so many ways you can do it, and there's so many different ways that you can measure HRV as well. And there are certain indices that are better measured over longer time frames and certain indices that are better measured over shorter time frames. So to get into the nitty-gritty of HRV, there's two main indices of HRV that most people talk about. These are time domain analysis, which is basically looking at standard deviations and you know, the variation of the gap between beats. And then the other one is spectral analysis or frequency domain analysis, that's also known, which is looking at the frequency of change. So how frequently something's changing. So if something's changing a lot in a high frequency, it means that there's more parasympathetic activity. If something is changing at a low frequency, it's not changing a lot. This means there's generally more sympathetic activity. But what's also important to realize with HRV is that with all these indices, we're not actually ever measuring sympathetic activity. We're only measuring parasympathetic activity. But because the two are kind of balancing each other out, if parasympathetic activity is low, we therefore assume that sympathetic activity is high, and vice versa. If parasympathetic activity is high, sympathetic activity is therefore low. So that's how we look at it.
I find it interesting that there's so much variation between individuals. So, for example, when you're looking at a standard HRV measurement via a Whoop, which I don't know what your thoughts are on the validity. Like, for me, to get a really true HRV reading, you have to get an EKG. That's just in my humble opinion. And I don't know how valid a Whoop is or an Oura Ring when we're really looking at HRV. However, let's just say that they're a great measurement. And let's say that patient X, 32 years old, has a HRV and he's at his healthiest, he's feeling great, his HRV is 101. But then you've got patient Y, who's, you know, let's just say she's also very healthy, around the same age, but her HRV is 220. Why is there so much variation between the two?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of factors that most people miss when it comes to HRV is that you also have to look at both things into account with resting heart rate as well. Because in athletes, you often see quite low levels of HRV because of something called HRV saturation. And in HRV, with HRV saturation, what happens is the HRV is basically it's vagal modulation, so it's not measuring vagal tone, vagal modulation. So what that means is it's trying to control your heart rate all the time, whereas vagal tone is actually what is being present consistently. What I liken it to is that if you have a sponge, for example, and it's really really wet, and you want to keep that sponge at a certain degree of wetness, you would always keep pouring water on it to keep it at a certain degree of wetness. But if that sponge becomes so saturated and so wet that it's always that as wet as you want it, you actually don't have to pour water on it so much, which means, and the water is actually the HRV. So that means that the HRV goes down even though the vagal tone is quite high. And in athletes, you actually see that quite a lot, and that's known as HRV saturation, which is why you often have to look at both resting heart rate and HRV at the same time, because at points when an athlete has a very low resting heart rate, they can fall in and out, and HRV can go down, but it's not actually that they're more sympathetic, it's actually that they're more, they're actually going into the HRV saturation. And it's because the acetylcholine receptors become saturated at the heart level, and therefore that you don't have to affect it so much with the HRV. It's quite complicated. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, look, it makes sense. It definitely makes sense. And it is very complicated, which is why brings me to my next question. And that is, why has it gained so much traction over the last 5 years? Something so complex to just be able to now in every single day be able to read it and measure whether you're ready to train or whether you didn't get enough sleep. Why are we all of a sudden looking at HRV metrics?
Yeah, well, I think when it comes down to this kind of thing, I think it comes back to, you know, cost benefit sort of thing. And when I first started doing my PhD, When I did my PhD, we measured HRV using a polar heart rate monitor. So you'd have to do it with a strap. You'd have to wake up in the morning and you'd have to take 5 minutes of recording. And that 5 minutes of recording, you'd basically, you take out the last 3 minutes. And that was all manual as well. So you know, at the time I was working with the rowing team, the Olympic rowing team in New Zealand, and I was measuring heart rate variability a lot with them. You know, it's so manual. They would take it in the morning. They would bring me the heart rate monitor. I would download it. I would analyze it. And it'd be a real lengthy process. But just through the evolution of technology, we've kind of now just developed better and better ways. Whereas we used to start with your 5 minute measurement, or worse than that, we'd do like the more standing to seating measures as well, which is another way that you can measure HRV, which is even longer, where you'd have to do 5 minutes supine, then 5 minutes standing, and look at the differences between your standing and your supine. And it was such a long process. Whereas now you can measure it with just the PPG technology, using the camera on your phone, for example, or a Whoop or an O-ring, takes out all of the necessary tasks for you to do, or your athletes to do. So that means the compliance is much higher. And it also it's also immediately an analyzed as well. So we don't have to do anything ourselves. So at the start, I think the cost was quite high as a individual or as a trainer or as a physiologist, whatever it might be. But now we're at the position where it's so easy to do that the cost is quite low, but the benefit can actually be quite high. And of course, our level of understanding of what everything means is really, really important as well. And just to finish off, so now we're in the position where, you know, we can not only have all these different technologies, we've also realized that we can probably get almost the same measure of just 1 to 2 minutes of recordings as well, which I think is also really, really important.
Yeah, look, it's I don't know what your thoughts are, and I hate just putting, you know, I hate putting different things on the spot here, and this is in by no means you know, I'm not trying to out any companies, but is there anything that I think that you're aware of when you're looking at HRV from an, I don't know if I only know HRV recordings from a Whoop and an Aura. I don't know any other device that's actually doing that as well as what they are, but I also don't know too much about the validity behind it. I've heard a lot of different reviews saying that the Aura ring takes a much more rapid and much more thorough reading of HRV as opposed to the Whoop. I would love to know what your take is on that.
Yeah, well, okay, so let's just leave Whoop and Aura out for the moment, because the, you know, PPG technology using the camera on your phone is, you know, HRV for training. And these apps are actually very, very good, and they're very, very valid. I actually published a paper in the International Journal of Sports Physiology and Performance that validated the PPG technology against ECG and polar, and also did polar heart monitor at the same time. And it was pretty much one for one. You know, we're in the fortunate position that we have good control, because you can theoretically measure all three at the same time and look at the differences between the three. And it was highly varied, had an effect size that was almost zero between all devices. So we're in the position where actually that PPG technology using the camera on your phone is very good and valid and easy to use. And when it comes to, and the good thing about that is that you have to do it yourself. So you wake up first thing in the morning and you take your measurement with your phone. It's controlled. It's at the same time. It's at the same time when you wake up. On the other side, we have the Oura Ring and the Whoop, which take HRV during an entire night's sleep. So this in itself is reasonably problematic, because Oura Ring is better because it takes it during a whole night of sleep. And I've read some papers that have validated Oura Ring, and it seems to be quite close. But with the Whoop, the measure of HRV is actually very good. But the problem with this is that they take 5 minutes of HRV recording during slow wave sleep. And the problem isn't with the HRV recording, it's actually in the detection of slow wave sleep. That's where you really get a problem with being more valid, because HRV changes all through the night, and it changes in accordance with the stage of sleep you're at. And basically HRV will increase, and it's highest during slow wave sleep. Your HRV is at the, so HF or RMSSD or whatever measure of HRV you're looking at is at this highest point during slow wave sleep. So if you're trying to detect where that slow wave sleep is, if you're getting that wrong, you're pretty much measuring different things at different different days, and that's where the real problem can actually lie. So, yeah. Oh.
And what's also fascinating is when you have to charge the, you know, I heard that there's a lot of, I've been reading as well that there's a lot of inaccuracies in the HRV wrist straps. That's where this question came from. But I wanted to, you know, I was really interested in finding out when you want to actually charge your watch or whatever that is, you have to take it off your wrist. A lot of people do, and maybe they forget it, then they put it back on. And that there lies a lot of misinformation in HRV recordings, right?
No, because it's only taking it during the night, right? It's not taking it the whole, I mean, the HRV recording is only taken at night. It's not taken during the whole day. So as long as you've got it on and you've got it reasonably tight, and you're not moving, then you're pretty sweet, really. I don't think it's really going to affect whether you're having it charged or what. I mean, it will miss that period during the day, but it's not really measuring your HRV during the day. The Oura Ring measures it for the whole night of sleep. The Whoop tries to measure it in slow wave sleep during the night. So as long as you've got it on during those periods, the HRV will be what the HRV will be.
I am so happy that you said that. That was actually, I don't know if many people know that, but that was very insightful for me. I actually didn't know that it took it during the night. So that was, that's really great to know. So you're, Dan, right now you're focusing on your coaching business. You've also got, you know, you coach a lot of high level athletes, and you've also got a program, but we'll get into that a bit later. I'm very interested to know about how you do your block training based on HRV. I'm sure not all of your training when you're training your athletes is based on HRV, but I know that a substantial amount is. What's the correlation between training and HRV? How do you get your athletes ready, or how do you periodize your training blocks and programs based around HRV?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's been a lot of studies that have been done in HRV guided training, for one. So, just to talk a little bit about those studies, the HRV guided training studies, they'll either look at in isolated days. So the earlier studies that was done by the Finnish group, it was a paper in 2007 and 2009, they looked at HRV on a given day. So that athlete would wake up in the morning and measure the HRV. And if HRV was, I think it was 2 standard deviations below the mean, they would do low intensity training. And if it was, within the mean or above the mean, they would do high intensity training. And that showed that they did that twice. And basically on both occasions, it showed that performance measures, VO2 max and performance measures, were better when athletes were doing HRV guided training versus traditional, just following a normal training program. Mm-hmm. But since then, there's been some other HRV guided training. One that I was involved in, looked at specifically block periodization versus HRV guided training, where it looks more at rolling averages. And it's, and in these papers, they establish what's known as the smallest worthwhile change. So it will look at individuals' HRV data for a 4-week period, and then look at, okay, what after this 4 weeks, what is 0.5 of the SD and the gain? You'd have bars above, a threshold above and a threshold below to detect what is meaningful for that individual. And then if that person on a rolling average, which is a 7-day rolling average, if that rolling average of the HRV would fall below 1.5 of an SD below, they would do low intensity training. And if it was in the middle or high, they would do moderate intensity or high intensity training. And again, these studies, they basically have shown that 9 times out of 10, people are having better performance outcomes and better improvements in fitness when they're following HRV guided training. So that's kind of the prerequisite of how HRV guided training works. But of course, HRV can be used in many other aspects as well, in terms of when to change training, when to insert recovery weeks and whatnot. So with my athletes, I use it mainly on quite the global level. I don't ever predefine recovery periods, for example. So with the athletes that I train, I will never say, okay, we're going to do a 3-week block and then we're going to take 1 week easy. We're going to do another 3-week block and then we're going to take 1 week easy. I will always just keep pushing that effort and give them a recovery period as and when they need it based on the heart rate variability. So I had a prime example the other day where, you know, I have an idea of when I want the athlete to do a recovery, but I will never have it set in stone, because 9 times out of 10, I'll be pushing through it because HRV is good and it's high and stable. Or that might even start a little bit earlier and do a shorter recovery period based on, because the HRV is low. as a coach, what I'm always trying to do is avoid really long recovery periods. I find it much more effective to do shorter recovery periods more frequently than longer recovery periods more infrequently.
Yeah. What's the duration of the short recovery periods? Are we talking one day or merely just a night off?
Yeah, it's two. Generally, I find 2 to 3 days is what is best for, you know, but it's not when you say recovery, it's just a bit of easy training. That's kind of, I find that's best for most athletes, 2 to 3 days. Because if you catch them early enough, they don't need much longer than that generally. And that's how I'll typically do it. It generally works really well. And I find that athletes, they keep progressing much more fluidly rather than having, you know, rather than getting too tired that they need a really big recovery period. And also then that like recovery period, having a loss in like chronic training load, which can be also be not ideal. And you, if you measure anything like chronic training load is basically you look at the average training load over the past 42 days. And, you know, doing it this way, I just find it's a much better way to keep that CTL, as we call it, consistently moving up. Whereas if you plan and you think, right, I'm going to take a big recovery period, big recovery week, as most coaches will do, you get just too big a reductions in that CTL all the time. But this is the way of just keeping it up and moving at a much more linear and easy way, really.
Well, on the subject of recovery, I think that's another huge talking point right now. We're finding so many companies now, technology is advancing around this whole world of recovery. I don't know what your take is on recovery and what you're currently doing, but one of the best things that I've started to employ is ice baths, not cryotherapy, but I absolutely love the theory of cold thermogenesis. There's a lot of validity and a lot of science that goes behind it, especially from a neurological level. Right now in New York City, so I live pretty much between Australia and New York. So back home in Australia, I have my own ice bath. Very hard to do that here in New York City. But that's one thing that I think has really helped me in not just my recovery, but it helps me in so many ways, whether I do an ice bath during the morning or at, you know, in the afternoon. That's something that I really, really love. I don't know what you're doing currently for yourself and for your athletes, but I'd love to know a bit of a protocol that you've got in place.
Yeah. So with that, the really interesting thing is you look at a lot of the research behind ice baths and, you know, originally it was Paula Radcliffe, the marathon runner, who actually started doing this kind of thing with the ice baths. But so people thought it was a more of a muscle damage issue, right? And they were looking at, you know, there was a lot of research, and they looked at creatine kinase and changes in like dehydrogenase in terms of markers of muscle damage. But lo and behold, they could never really find anything. And but what has been shown time and time again is that parasympathetic reactivation really does increase with cold water immersion. And Jamie Stanley, who had the same supervisor as me, he published a number of papers on this that showed that people who do ice baths, they do get increases in their parasympathetic activity immediately post. So I think ice bath has its place. I do think it can be, from a recovery standpoint, it can sometimes be overdone. I don't necessarily think you need to do it after you've just done a session where heart rates have been maintained quite low. So like a long, like endurance session where you've not really gone over your aerobic threshold, it's quite easy. I don't think you need to jump in a recovery ice bath then. But anything that's particularly high intensity with high heart rates, highly sympathetic, then that would be a period of time when you could actually really consider doing some cold water immersion after. In terms of like, I mean, I actually have a chest freezer set right behind me. But I'm
that's what I have. That's my version of an ice bath back home.
Yeah. So I haven't set it up yet, but I've got a sauna at home and I'm going to set it up outside next to the sauna as well. And the reason being, I mean, as you say, it just one of the main things that I find is, yes, it does increase your parasympathetic activity, but also another thing that I find it really does is lower your blood glucose. So, yes. You know, blood glucose is a real important measure of health and overall wellness, and having, you know, not low, but, you know, blood glucose between 4 and 8 millimoles all the time, keeping it in that range and not too varied has been shown to be quite a healthy way to do it, and a healthy way to healthy marker of overall health and longevity. So I find that that's quite a good way to to get that quite stable as well. If I go in the morning, for example, and I've had a real, I've not eaten that well the night before, I jump in there, I just find it really sets me up quite well. And also if I jump in and then eat a meal, because I use a continuous blood glucose monitor, it doesn't really affect me in the same way either. So there's so many great benefits, as well as you just feel so much better and alert after doing it as well. So
I'm really happy that you said that. Just on the whole response of doing a long run, hard run, even if you're doing weight training session for hypertrophy, studies show that if you get into an ice bath within around a 2 or 3 hour time frame after doing a hard session, you actually block the hormetic response. So it's very, I don't agree with, you know, going out and doing a hard session and blocking that response, because you do want that increased inflammation there. So you can be growing and can be, you know, getting the results from your training session. So that's why I tend to do it either first thing in the morning or I'll do it in the afternoon. So I really love that. I also love how you've drawn a correlation between the CGM. I'm currently wearing a CGM. I cycle through them. Unfortunately, I go, you know, 3 or 4 months with it and it's amazing. And then sometimes I'll just, you know, go off it for 2 months, but I've just, you know, gotten back on it for the next 3 months. And it's absolutely incredible to see how even, you know, a drop of alcohol, okay, I may not even see the results on my blood glucose, but my God, wine for me, and unfortunately the last 2 days, Sunday, yesterday, I had 2 glasses of beautiful wine. I was celebrating and my HRV just plummeted. So why don't we go into some of the things that decrease and plummet your HRV? Because for me, some of the questions that I have is sleep a really big performance factor when it comes to HRV? And the second one is, why does alcohol, even a glass of wine, plummet my HRV?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I have actually never really looked at the internal physiology of why alcohol does that. But it's funny you mentioned that, because I was actually just having a chat with my wife. We went away this weekend. We stayed at a friend's batch, and, you know, had drank more than we normally would. And, you know, usually I don't really drink at all. But so we were there Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night, and every single night I was waking up, every single morning I was waking up with quite a low HRV. We came home yesterday and, you know, I didn't drink the whole night. I had a good night's sleep and I just looked after myself a little bit more. And then first time woke up this morning and I had a really high HRV score again. So if I find that out of all things, alcohol affects me massively. And I don't know what would be the internal physiology of that. Really, I would have to look into it. So
yeah, that's definitely something I'm going to look into as well.
Yeah, but I think nearly everyone has the same sort of response, right? So it's super interesting. And another thing, generally, there is a link between blood glucose and HRV. So people typically, if you have a higher blood glucose level, you have lower HRV. So there's definitely a link there as well. So if you eat crappy food and you sleep through the night with typically higher levels of blood glucose, your HRV will be worse that next morning, because it's due to inflammation and it's due to that whole cascade of events, increased inflammation, more sympathetic, therefore lower HRV. So if you eat late, for example, and you eat not that well, and that doesn't necessarily mean high sugared foods, it can mean foods that are high in poor oils like canola oil and whatnot, that can also really affect your blood sugar and therefore affect your HRV. One of the main things, because I actually am on the scientific advisory board for Super Sapiens, which is a CGM.
That's the company I'm using.
So I'm on the scientific advisory.
Oh, congratulations. It's a great, you know, it's the UX of it is absolutely amazing. I just put it on 2 days ago and just watching it in real time on my app is amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, now you can actually get that you can actually live stream it onto Garmin. So the Super Sapiens were quite interested in, obviously endurance sports, and specifically they're partnered with Ironman Triathlon. So, you know, I help them with content and some of the creations and the usability of the product around, fueling, training, and substrate use and monitoring and all that. So looking at this, when I wear the CGM, and I wear it quite often, more than anything, is almost more than carbohydrate that affects my CGM is poor oil. So eating out, you eat out a lot, that's something that you really will find that will affect your HRV and your blood glucose quite a lot, just because generally they'll always cook in not the best of oils, you know, generally be vegetable oil, canola oil, and these polyunsaturated oils. So, yeah.
Have you found any great information regarding sauna use, like especially, I don't know what sauna you have at home, but how that directly impacts your HRV?
Yeah, so I mean, I have a sauna at home, yeah, and it's a Finnish sauna, so it's a dry sauna, I went for the dry sauna because a couple of reasons is because I want to use it for if I have to race, like doing an Ironman triathlon. If I want to race in a hot climate, it's more specific because it's more environmental rather than heating. You know, it's the difference between being sat in an oven than sat in a microwave. So it's kind of more specific to actually being in a hot climate. It's also much faster to get hot. I feel that I have to sit in the infrared a lot longer than 20 minutes to kind of get the same level of increase in heart rate and even core temperature. Because I have this device that can measure, that can sit on your skin, and the surrogate marker of core temperature, which is called the core device, which is quite cool. But so that's the reason I got it. But when it comes to HRV, yes, it will increase your HRV, but it's kind of a different mechanism to cold water. So one of the main things with consistent sauna use is hypervolemia, which is basically increases in blood plasma volume. So when with any kind of heat exposure, one of the main things of heat acclimation is that you store more water in your blood, which is called hypervolemia, which is increases in blood plasma volume. And when you store more water in your blood, this is detected by baroreceptors, which they detect pressure or stretch. And as a result, you have increases in heart rate variability. So that's one of the mechanisms, which is actually quite acute. And you can see that in a few days of consistent sauna use. Mm. And the other side, if you had to look at the hierarchy of increasing HRV, the main thing that will definitely increase your HRV is low intensity aerobic endurance exercise. And sauna is, for many people, is just that. People can sit in the sauna and it mimics cardiovascular exercise. So it can, my wife can sit in there and her heart rate's nearly 160. So yeah. It's like, you know, so you're actually getting a good exercise boost at the same time. And we know that low intensity exercise will increase your heart rate variability over time as well, because of all those reasons that are associated with more health and longevity.
Look, I'm all about mimicking cardiovascular exercise. So if I can get the same benefits, which it has proven, I don't know if you've read the manuscripts from Rhonda Patrick, but she talks a lot about sauna use, evidently. And when I first read about this from her, she said, you know, it mimics cardiovascular exercise, aerobic exercise. I was like, well, this is great. I would love to take out, you know, one of my long runs and inject a sauna session. So it's like a, you know, kill two birds with one stone. So when we're talking about training, something that I've implemented this is taking a leaf out of Inigo San Malon's book. And he was the one who really introduced zone two training to me. And I started to get into that and I, you know, went and found myself buying a $450 a lactate meter, which is completely ridiculous. And even the strips are ridiculous. They cost so much money. But of course, I went and bought it because, like you, I'm a bit of a junkie when it comes to science and metrics. Do you train in that area at all with your athletes?
Yeah, well, the majority of our training is in that area, really. We very much prescribe to a polarized model of training, which is 80%, pretty much 80% of your training is below like level two. So like, wow. For those who don't know, like, level two is basically it's below the first aerobic threshold. So if you were taking a lactate test, it would be the point at which lactate first begins to rise. The idea is that for most people that's around 2 millimole, but that's not actually true. It's it can vary amongst a lot of athletes. Like, you know, if someone who's very, very fit and has a lot of slow twitch fibers and they're very good at removal of lactate, you know, they can be, you can measure them in the lab and they would be 0.5, 0.6, 0.8. And then they go to 1.5. That would be their zone two. So it's not always fixed to 2 millimole, just for the listeners' information. But yeah, we do a lot of that. So we always switch between, because most of my athletes are training for long distance triathlon, 70.3 Ironman distance. We'll always start with quite a polarized approach, whereas a little bit more zone two. And as we get closer to competition, we shift more to what I would like to call, or what is known as a pyramidal training intensity distribution, which has a little bit more time between the first aerobic threshold and the second anaerobic threshold. Mostly because as training becomes more specific to the competition, Ironman triathlon and 70.3 triathlon is specifically within that range. So you naturally kind of progress more to that pyramidal. But the majority of the training, you're talking 60-70%, is still level two endurance type training.
I still think it's very misunderstood, even for myself. Like for me to maintain under 2 millimole, it is so difficult for me. I don't know. And also, I know that you have to take it while, like if I go on a stationary bike, for example, and I'm set up to do a 45 minute to 60 minute ride, really low intensity zone two, I'm looking at my heart rate at the same time. I'm trying to look at my power, my watts. And it's just so insane. Every time I take a strip, every time I do a pinprick, my millimoles are definitely over two. For me to maintain two or just under, for some reason, it's just so damn difficult.
Yeah, and there goes why the individuality of it is so important. And on me, on the other side, I actually have to be going pretty hard to be going over 2 millimoles because I'm very, very yeah. slow.
And you're at mid training, aren't you?
Sorry,
are you? Yeah,
I still train quite a lot, and you know, I'm still reasonably fit. So like, it's really hard. I mean, but my 2 millimole is way over my level two. I'm definitely more of like a 1.5. I remember in the old lactate meters, my lactates were always so low that the lactate meters would never record them. It would always just come up as low because my lactates were that low that you couldn't, the precision of the lactate meter couldn't actually get that low. So I was always quite a low lactate kind of guy. So for me to be over two is quite, it's quite something. So yeah, that's why heart rate, I think, heart rate is always the best measure regardless. And whether you need to be collecting your lactate all the time, I'm not really so sure. If you have a good measure of heart rate, that's enough, because it's a true measure of physiological stress. So if you can just pinpoint where that level two occurs in terms of heart rate, then you can use heart rate as your main measure. An interesting thing that's come out recently in a lot of the research is this is actually using HRV to detect level two or to detect the aerobic threshold through something called the DFA 1 alpha method, which looks at the relationship between HRV and the change in heart rate. And it's the correlation, really. And as you become more sympathetic and you increase exercise intensity, the correlation becomes less. So the relationship between what the HRV is doing and the change in your heart rate becomes less because you're becoming more sympathetic. This is probably something that I should have explained at the start, actually, because the reason that there is more variation with parasympathetic activity is because the parasympathetic system is much quicker to react. So because it's very quick to react, you see changes in heart rate much more frequently, whereas the sympathetic system is much slower to react, which is why why the frequency of change is much less, because it doesn't change heart rate between the time between beats that quickly, if that kind of makes sense. And that's what this HRV DFA 1 alpha method is looking at, the relationship between the two, with the idea is that once you get past 0.75 in terms of a correlation between the two, you're past your aerobic threshold. And it's been shown, like being studied a lot, people have been doing it even just with real-time data in exercise, and it can really pick out where your aerobic threshold is.
So are you currently, Let's now that we've gotten all of that information, let's talk a bit about nutrition. And in some of the episodes that I've listened to you, I believe you promote a ketogenic diet for some people, others not so much. What is it about diet that can go in and interfere with our HRV or even our heart rate? Because I know that with a lot of people, everything's different. You know, the way that your body will respond to a ketogenic diet is very different to how my body would respond to a ketogenic diet. So how does nutrition correlate to HRV?
Yeah, well, I guess I'll start with I don't really promote a ketogenic diet. I promote a low carb diet or a lower carb diet. I think ketogenic diets definitely have their place, but I think it's more with people who are, you know, maybe type 2 diabetic or pre-diabetic and have severe like insulin resistance, then for those particular people, it might have a good place. But for athletes, I don't really promote that. But I do promote a lower carb diet, with the idea is that you traditionally are on a lower carb diet, but then you add in carbohydrates when you need it, rather than some of the other approaches that you just crush the carbs all the time and then go lower carb when you want to. Because to me, that's just not as a healthy way to do it, because we just don't need that much carbohydrate for one. And at the end of the day, we want to be maintaining low stable blood sugar and blood glucose, as most people, as we've already discussed, it is generally a healthier outcome for most people. So, but that being said, it comes down to your tolerance, right? And what you need in your levels of exercise and what you're trying to achieve. For Ironman triathlon, having a high fat metabolism is really, really important. So you want to be pushing that in some way, and that can be pushed and achieved very nicely for a lower carb diet, but it's not necessarily for every single sport, because, you know, having a high fat metabolism, but running a 10K or running a 400 meters is not going to change the outcome of the event. But for Ironman triathlon, it definitely will change the outcome of the event. And what I generally push or suggest is that everyone should go lower, but finding that optimal point for you based on your HRV and what your blood glucose is doing is really important. And you can't measure what you don't measure, which is where HRV and blood glucose is really, really key.
Have you gone through and done any blood work? Like, do you do lipid panels like regularly? Are you looking at any biomarkers of inflammation to track and measure the performance of your athletes?
I have done a lot of it in the past. I can't say I do it super regularly. But generally, blood triglycerides are super, super low. I've never really had any issues with any athletes. I mean, even on the courses, we've got a low carb performance course as part of Enduro IQ. We've had like nearly 800 people through there, and we've never had, you know, lots of them do their blood work and, you know, blood triglycerides just always get lower. C-reactive protein, level of inflammation, homocysteine, they're always in the way to improvement. And we've always been pretty, pretty fortunate in that. But I think it's because we're never that extreme either. And it's titrating it based on the responses of your HRV and your blood glucose as well. Because if you're managing those two and your HRV is high and stable and you've got lower and stable blood glucose, you're always going to be pretty sure that everything else is going to be taking care of itself as well.
So you mentioned Endure IQ. Take me through that. I'm excited because it seems really exciting and at the forefront of what I believe is going to be the future of training.
Yeah. So I guess Endure IQ, we're made up of two distinct parts. So one is, we like to educate athletes and coaches. So we have a number of courses that is all around performance and the improvement of performance. So we've got a course that's on low carb performance. We've got a course that's just on long distance triathlon training. We've got a course on heat and heat acclimation. And we're just about to launch a course on athlete monitoring. And then we've also got a short course on specifically HRV, so heart rate variability. With the idea is, you know, our motto is that, you know, this health, performance and enjoyment in the, I think it's really sad that a lot of athletes, they'll take up Ironman triathlon or take up long distance triathlon because they're trying to make a better outcome in their health or better outcomes in their lifestyle. But often they end up, you know, burnt out, tired, training too much, sleeping poorly. And I think it's what we try to do is say, okay, you can have all three. You can have a good performance. You can improve your health and you can enjoy it at the same time. And, you know, with the correct knowledge and the correct details, that's what we try and make sure athletes are getting. And that comes down to, you know, what we talked about is making sure you're doing the correct low intensity, monitoring the right things, a little bit of diet. So that's the course side of things. But then on the other side, we have something called our HRV, Endure IQ training squad. And the Enduro IQ training squad is a big squad where we have lots of different sessions. We have weekly webinars where people can talk around all the things they're doing. All the sessions are scalable to your needs, so you can make them longer, you can make them shorter. We've got loads of different plans that you can pull in at a time, and then a great group of coaches who you can consult with on a weekly webinar. So and that's been going really well as well. But it's all based around. All those core things that we believe are really important, which is HRV and health.
That is so wonderful. We're going to direct everybody to that website as well. We'll link everything below in the show notes. So wrapping up, what's your take on the future of, it's a very broad question. I want to say the future of training for elite athletes, but we can go a bit narrow and just talk about the future of HRV in your opinion.
Well, I mean, one of the other things that I'm working on or a part of at the moment is I'm a co-founder in a company called Trick. And that's basically I don't like to use the word AI, but it is AI training and programming. So the training automatically changes based on your responses as an athlete. So what it does is it will try to automatically assess your individual recovery rate. So as you as an athlete, you might come in and we'll look at what your background is, what your fitness is, and then say, okay, we expect you to recover from this particular training load at a given rate. And then the system wouldn't allow you to do a high intensity session or a session that we don't think is suitable for you at the time because you're not recovered enough. Then over time, given the inputs that you put in, whether it's a bit of mood, like your muscle soreness, your motivation to train, your mood, and your HRV, it will continuously titrate and perfect your own individual recovery score, which may be faster, it may be slower. But the important thing is that the training always changes based on based on your own individuality, because at the end of the day, as coaches, we want to make sure our athletes complete the session that we give them. And I think that's the future of where HRV is going to lie, is it's going to be great at understanding recovery rate of individuals in more of a granular level.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think as technology just gets greater and greater and we learn more, I think it's going to be really great to have something, AI, incorporated into that. I don't know if you're aware, but actually I mentioned earlier, the only two measurements of HRV that I know of is obviously the Whoop, the Aura, whatever, so on and so forth, Garmin, but I actually also have a performance mattress. I don't know if you've delved into that, but this mattress cools up, it cools down, it warms up, it tells you when to get up, like it vibrates in the morning. But it also has, when you look at the app in the morning, I don't get my readings from here, but it does give you a measure of HRV. So I think that's really important too. And it kind of goes in line with what you said with the Whoop, where the Whoop is taking the measurement of HRV of 5 minutes during your deep sleep. Maybe that's what this mattress is doing too. I have to read more into it. But I think that's just fascinating. Technology is insane.
Yeah, that I'm really interested in that. I'd love to hear about that. Is that a full mattress or is it like a sheet?
Yeah, no. So I've got the actual mattress, but they also do a cover, Pod Pro cover. The company's called 8 Sleep. So like the number 8 Sleep. And it's absolutely
I don't think you can get it in New Zealand.
I don't know. I'm going to have to get them to start shipping. I want my parents sleeping on one. I'm going to have to get them to start shipping to Australia, because let me tell you, it's been a game changer for me. I'm one to, when I go to sleep, it really frustrates me that I get hot during the night. And there's this thing, like you can actually program it for your partner. If your partner, you're sleeping next to your partner and your partner's like, I don't want the mattress to be cold. It's like, okay, well, you sleep on your side, and actually has that capabilities to go into the app and say, well, Louisa is sleeping on the right side, partner's sleeping on the left. So it's absolutely phenomenal. And it's just been a game changer for me, because we know that in order to get into deep sleep, our core body temperature needs to drop around 2 to 3 degrees lower than homeostasis. So that's been a game changer. Now, before we end, I'd love to know one thing, and that's based on the neurological aspect. So that's what I do, neuroscientist, neurophysiologist. I now combine I live at the intersection of neuroscience and elite athleticism. And everything I do is not, I don't do the physical. I do everything from neurological, whether it's doing brain scans, whether it's looking at MRIs, and, developing protocols around that. One of the protocols is sleep. I do look at HRV as well. What's your take on that? And are you doing anything to, I wouldn't say enhance the neurological function of your athletes, but is this something that you're looking into?
So how do you increase the neurological function in your athletes? Is that mainly through sleep, or is it, do you do some movement pattern stuff?
It's another 1 hour conversation, but I think another question would be, well, how am I tracking and measuring it? One primary modality of neuroimaging I'm using is an EEG. So we're doing a lot of, we've got our own EEG. It's a hospital grade EEG. Go in, and it's got an EKG attached to it as well. So we do a reading and we take timestamps of, we find out what their visual acuity is. We do a complete analysis of their brain. We find out memory. We do reaction training all from an EEG. And then we can then go and develop protocols from that.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I don't know if that's ever actually been studied or even looked at, because I don't think anyone's really had the information available to them. I'd be super interested though. I guess you could be one of the first people who might have more of an insight into that if you collect them both at the same time. Is reaction time better when HRV is higher, or is it better when HRV is lower? Who knows? It could be the actual converse, right? Because if it's a bit lower, you're more sympathetic, you're more fight or flight, so you're more acutely aware. That might be something that's of massive interest, because my feeling is that different sports will benefit from different HRV levels. So it's not necessarily mean that high HRV is better for every single sport. You might actually find the converse for some sports. A lower HRV might mean that you're more reactive. It might mean you're slightly more sympathetic. But of course, most of the research is done in endurance sports. So having a high HRV is linked to higher blood plasma volume. That the higher blood plasma volume is certainly linked to better endurance performance. So I think, it depends on the sport, and I don't think we really understand what that's happening yet. And we can't certainly do a blanket approach in terms of how they're presenting to perform well. The high HRV is the best thing to see.
So you could correlate HRV then to a hedge fund, for example, somebody who's trading. Let's look at, I've got a group of portfolio managers who are so highly strung. Some of them are trading securities. Like they're just, they're so, I can't even explain to you how stressed they can be. And it's interesting to, I don't know if anybody, or if you've seen any data around taking HRV training into the corporate world or to Wall Street or anything like that. But I think that would be a really good performance indicator of whether you're going to make a good trade or a bad trade.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things there. I think that, it has been shown that people with high HRV or high levels of HRV can cope with more stress generally. So because, and you think about what it means, it gives you a bigger sink, right, before you overflow. If you're someone with a high HRV, you can generally cope with a lot more on your plate generally, and that's been shown in the research, it's been shown in the studies. So anything with a hedge fund manager or someone who is in a highly stressed business world, you want to be doing things that can help as much as you can to push the HRV back up, because it will help them cope on with day-to-day stresses much more easily. As you imagine, if you start the day with a low HRV, you get more stress. You start the next day with a low HRV, you get more stress. It's only a matter of time before you get burnout. So with being smart and monitoring it, there's certain things you can do, low intensity exercise, meditation, breathing, gratitude journaling, sauna, working on your
hypnosis.
Diet to help the HRV come up would be really, really important for those particular people. And you can't just burn the candle at both ends, so to speak.
Dan, this was really, really phenomenal. Where I know everybody's going to be asking, where can we find out more about you and your business and maybe even get involved in some of your courses? So why don't you point us towards that?
Yeah. So I'm guessing on the social media, I'm probably most active on Instagram, which is at the Plues. And then we also have an Endure IQ Facebook group, which is free to join. It's a closed group, and we put loads of information all around. It's called the Endure IQ Performance and Longevity Insights. So it's not just about triathlon and performance. We put a lot of stuff in there around health and basically living a longer and healthier life. So it's kind of for everyone. And then the endureiq.com is our website. And as I said before, what we want to do for your audience, Louisa, is we have, because this is all about HRV, we have the HRV course, which is EndureIQ 201, it's called, which is all around HRV, the practical application of it. But for your audience, we'll also put in a specific module on heat training as well, because I think that will interest a lot of people, that will be free of charge just for your audience.
Oh, that's absolutely incredible. Dan, thank you so much for being part of the Neuro Experience podcast.
No, thanks for having me on.